The clinical research advances discussed by Drs. Chris, Perez-Soler, and Bramer are difficult to put in perspective because so much has happened in the last 5 years. I met with Dr. Philip Bonomi and took a step back to chat about where we were, where we are, and where we might be headed in clinical lung cancer research.
Right around 2000 or the end of the 90s, everybody pretty much started to come to the conclusion we were at a plateau with the chemo. You could give more courses, you could mix drugs, you could add 3 drugs, you could alternate drugs, give higher doses, didn't seem to make any difference. Once you used a platinum with one of the newer drugs, you know, they were all pretty much the same. They may all start to change now. And again, what I think is going to happen, and one of the things that we heard in Korea that was very interesting in relation to chemo, and I'll talk about the biologics in a second, but in relation to chemo, I was sort of thinking, I'd just forget chemo. And in fact, I even went on record at one point and said, well, we're beginning to see the end of chemo. But I don't think so. I think we're going to see chemo used in a different way. It's going to be used in a more targeted way. And it may be starting with something as simple as what was seen in a big randomized study comparing pemetrexate, cisplatin, gemcitabine, cisplatin, which was a 1,700-patient study. And in that, there were 1,000 people with non-squamous cell. They had adenos or large cells. And that group had significantly longer survival if they got pemetrexed versus gemcitabine. Now, this sort of flew in the face of, we always said, histology doesn't make any difference in relation to response, survival, as far as chemo goes. Here was something that everybody sort of said, wait a minute. And there's still, I think, many people who are skeptical, but there's going to be increasing data coming out to suggest that pemetrexed seems to work better in adenocarcinomas.
Is there a biologic explanation for that?
Well, one of the things that people are looking at is in the laboratory, in adenocarcinoma, lower levels of thymidylate synthase are found. And in the laboratory, when you look at different tumor types, lower thymidylate synthase seems to be associated with greater sensitivity to pemetrexed.
Not being a real fan of travel, I didn't go to Seoul this year, but I've heard a lot about that presentation. But I was surprised when I actually looked at the slides from it, and it was a huge study, as you say. And we heard a lot about how much of a difference there was, but to me, it didn't look like that great of a difference.
No, but I think the hazard ratio was like 0.8 or something, so it probably, well, Avastin and stuff like that, adding bevacizumab, the difference isn't that big either. So here is just, without doing anything different except selecting the patients, you seem to have an advantage, which isn't a home run. And all of the things, I mean, stage 4 disease to me has always been something we're trying to relieve symptoms, we're trying to prolong life, but it's actually a testing ground for new ideas that we are going to then move into earlier stage disease, locally advanced, and ultimately in the adjuvant setting, which we hope will translate into longer survival.
So we've got one issue here in terms of histology, but then we have other factors, particularly the biologics.
Yes, right. So the biologics, a couple of things. Many of us thought chemo not going anywhere with this, any more further advances. However, then we came out with the anti-EGFR tyrosine kinases, and it was very exciting to see tumors shrink heavily pretreated. We never saw anything like that. We knew these things were clearly different from what we had seen in the past. So we got very excited about it, and 4 large studies were launched in unselected patients, chemo plus or minus EGFR tyrosine kinase inhibitors. And if there ever was a situation where combination therapy principles would have predicted this was going to work, different mechanism of action, different overlapping major toxicities, this should work. But it didn't. As you know, they turned out to be, all 4 studies were negative. And in fact, if anything, the early portions of the survival curve almost suggested that there might be some antagonism between EGFR and chemo.
I think a lot of people kind of put that in the framework of sort of chemo and hormone therapy and breast cancer, which also doesn't work when used simultaneously.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a good analogy, Neil. I think there may be something to that.
What about the Bev story? What's been the bottom line there?
Well, the biggest bottom line is the current exclusion criteria that we're following, and we may see some of those start to change because there are studies looking at treated brain mets, can you use bevacizumab? But if you use the current guidelines are don't treat patients with brain mets with bevacizumab, don't treat squamous cell, don't treat people on anticoagulation, don't treat people with hemoptysis, again, a little softer cavitary to start with, lesions that are cavitary, lesions that are central, close to major blood vessels. If you follow all that stuff, my impression, and I don't have an actual count, is that only 35 or 40% of the people with stage four who walk through your door can actually go on those studies. So a large group are being excluded from getting bevacizumab. I do think bevacizumab certainly was a positive result in the ECOG study, and we see longer progression-free survival with a different platinum doublet. Don't have the survival data yet. It's a modest improvement, but again, the jump, what's happened is we're now moving that into the adjuvant setting, post-operative chemo plus or minus a beginner group study, which is ongoing. And in that group, obviously, we don't have the exclusions. We don't have brain. We don't have squamous. We do have anticoagulation, but otherwise it's... So can it make a bigger difference in early stage?
I don't want to get your take on where you think things are heading, particularly as cetuximab starts to come into the picture, but just talking about the two issues you just brought up in terms of EGFR and anti-angiogenesis, that in and of itself starts to create some sort of algorithms or pathways. And one of the trickiest ones, I think, from what I can see from the outside, is the patient who's a non-smoker who has an EGFR mutation, and where do you go first? Do you go to erlotinib? Do you go to carboplatin bev, or maybe even altogether? How do you approach those patients?
You know, again, we don't know the answer to that yet, Neil, but I do, and I think many other people do, the following thing, which is if you have somebody who you know has a mutation, or just on clinical grounds, you have an Asian woman with adenocarcinoma who never smoked, they have stage four lung cancer, I would give those people an EGFR TKI first and then save the chemo. They'll get chemo later. I wouldn't do them together. I know some people are doing that and considering that. I would do just the EGFR TKI and see what happens. They don't all respond. I mean, there's no question about that, but they have a relatively high response rate, higher than with chemo, actually.
In the patient who responds, what do you do after that when they progress or if they progress?
I would go to chemo. I would go to a chemotherapy
regimen.
Chemo
bev if they're in included?
Yes, 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 absolutely.
Any patients where you use erlotinib and bev together?
Yes, yes, we do. In fact, one classic patient I had was an individual who was eligible for a study. It was a chemo study plus bevacizumab with a different chemo regimen, and he didn't want to do that. He had a friend who advised him he should get erlotinib plus bevacizumab, and he did that. He had a large mass in his lung, multiple little nodules. He was a PS 1.5.
No chemo.
No chemo. He had extensive bone mets, and he went into remission for a year and a half. Unbelievable response. Yeah.
And you kept both agents going the whole year and a half?
I did. The Bev, I might have spaced it out a little more, 4 to 6 weeks, I think.
So now we have another issue coming on board, which is cetuximab. What do we know about it, and what do you think we're going to be knowing about it?
I think we're going to hear more about it at this year's ASCO. We do know there's a press release saying that chemo plus or minus cetuximab gave a positive result for cetuximab in patients who had EGFR expression by protein. And we have another study, which actually was presented in Seoul, which said that in unselected patients, there was a trend. I mean, it wasn't a spectacular trend, but it wasn't statistically significant in favor of adding the cetuximab to it. So I think when we see if this data come out at ASCO and show what we've heard in the press release, that there is a survival advantage, then especially the non-bevacizumab-eligible patients are going to start to get chemo plus cetuximab.
What was the chemo used?
In the European study, it was vinorelbine and cisplatin, but I'm pretty sure people will, unless the label specifies it has to be that particular regimen, I think people use their regimen of choice.
What about the issue of prediction or response to EGFR inhibitors, both antibodies as well as TKIs? We've seen a whole ton of things looked at. Where are we with that right now?
Well, we've actually done, you know, not a major amount. We've done some work in that area in our laboratory, and I've been following that closely, and I don't think we have the answer yet. What we're hoping, and we're looking at some stuff in other people, in fact, the Colorado group who's done so much work with the FISH analyses, perhaps the best thing to do is not so much try to identify the best responders, try to find the people who do the worst. Let's exclude them. Then the other people can, you know, be treated with these things. And my oversimplified clinician's viewpoint is people with mutations, they do the best. Quote, they're doing the best might simply be that they have a better prognosis, but they certainly have a higher response rate. I think FISH might be capturing the group that has responses plus stable disease, the, you know, disease control. But again, there's been some conflicting data. That FISH analysis is defined, you know, with pretty specific definitions, hasn't come out in every patient group that it's been applied to. So we don't know the answer.
I've been kind of surprised that mutation testing hasn't gotten widely implemented or utilized. You know, when I first heard about it, I figured that was what was going to happen. You know, kind of like ER and HER2 and breast cancer, I don't see it happening that much. Are you having your patients tested in a non-protocol situation?
Not routinely, Neil. And part of it is, take for instance, let's think about Herceptin. All right, so Herceptin is very good because it tells you that the group that's negative just isn't going to do well. And I think the reason that the mutation didn't make it is, you know, Neil, this is something that I think is really interesting. It's anecdotal, but the longest disease control patients that I've seen on EGFR inhibitors didn't get a bona fide partial remission. They just got stable disease. And again, some of them might have just had indolent disease to begin with, but I don't think they had the mutation because they didn't get these massive responses.
If you can kind of make that point again, because I think it's really important. The issue with lung cancer as opposed to HER2 is that you still can see benefit in patients who don't fall into these enriched populations.
That's correct. See, two things, like estrogen receptor and HER2 amplification, they tell us if you don't have that, you're really not going to do well. But the EGFR mutation, if you don't have it, it doesn't tell you that you're really not going to do well, because some of those people do very well.
In terms of responding.
Responding or disease control for a long time. And as I say, I have a number of patients, a handful of them, they're going for years, even still on ERISA, that they get the expanded access.
What about some of the newer agents that are being tested right now in metastatic disease? And what I wanted to ask you about is Zactima or ZD6474. What is it and what's been seen with it?
There are four very large studies that are going on right now, and how soon they'll actually be mature, I don't know. But you're looking at them in combination with chemo. They're looking at them in people who have been treated with an EGFR inhibitor before and progressed, and they're looking at a head-to-head comparison with the erlotinib. So if we extrapolate, we have several things here to think about. Is certainly looking at erlotinib plus bevacizumab, a single-arm study, pretty good results, 40 patients. Then a randomized phase 2, 40 patients per arm, again, almost identical results for the erlotinib and bevacizumab. I'm thinking things that hit both EGFR and VEGF are going to be better than either one alone. And we're hoping that Zactima is going to result in improved results too.
What do you see in terms of side effects and toxicity?
You see the EGFR toxicity, the rash and stuff. We participated in that study, which I guess is being submitted for publication. It was presented at ASCO last year as a poster discussion. And that study I'm referring to is first-line therapy, Zactima alone versus chemo plus Zactima. And what was seen is in unselected patients, the EGFR inhibitor wasn't as good as the chemo. And there's a couple things now that see that's another theme that I think is emerging. As first-line therapy, not after first-line, but as first-line therapy, if you use an EGFR inhibitor in unselected patients, you're not going to probably do as well as a platinum doublet. And Dr. Lillenbaum, who's one of the co-chairs of the ongoing meeting here, he has a paper that just came out showing that the idea was very good. Let's take the poor-risk patients, PS2, and give them either erlotinib or chemotherapy doublet. And although it wasn't powered to show a difference, survival and progression-free survival, very different in favor of the chemo.
What about VEGF side effects? Do you see that also with the 6474?
Yes, they have the same class effects, you know, hypertension, that type of thing. Bleeding, I don't know that they've seen that much bleeding, but hypertension could be seen with it, right? I think the thing that's going to happen is molecular profiles will start to have some, maybe as we start diagnosing lung cancers now, the paradigm might shift. It won't happen overnight. But even in stage 4, maybe you're going to be looking for core needle biopsies or getting a piece of tissue. And for instance, some of the things, what will we look at? Well, ERCC1, because that seems to be coming out fairly consistently. If that's low, platinum works. If the thing that we talked about earlier, that thymidylate synthase is important for pemetrexed, that it also, you know, so maybe we'll start to have a panel of things done on lung cancer patients like we have in breast cancer patients now.
What about stage 3 disease? What are some of the new ideas that are being tested in clinical trials?
First of all, I just summarize my thoughts about this. One is that concurrent chemotherapy and radiation are more effective than sequential chemotherapy and radiation. And concurrent chemotherapy, to be really effective, has to be given in full doses. And really the only of the regimens that can be done is etoposide and cisplatin, you know, an older regimen. And the thing that is most interesting in terms of new research and is going to be tested, is being tested by CALGB, and I think it's going to be tested in a big international study, is Limta plus either cisplatin or Limta plus carboplatin or pemetrexed. So pemetrexed, it looks like the work done by Dr. Boakes and his colleagues at University of Chicago could be given in full doses with carboplatin with concurrent radiation.
What about biologics?
Well, cetuximab is the one that is most likely to have a role there, I think, and we may hear some about that at this year's ASCO. Bevacizumab, that I think there's been some concern. There's been some tracheoesophageal fistulas. I think there are still some studies going on, but some have actually been stopped already, Neil.
What do we know about cetuximab in terms of chemoradiation and stage 3 disease?
Well, we know that it's being tested, I believe, by CALGB and RTOG. And the biggest thing we know is that very positive study in head and neck cancer.
Right.
I mean, and to me, just a note, I wonder why the head and neck cancer doctors have mounted a study of cetuximab radiation versus platinum radiation. Would they have a platinum radiation and cetuximab? I mean, three arms would be ideal, and maybe they don't have enough patients. But
what about the adjuvant setting? Obviously, we've seen a lot of changes in the last few years in terms of adjuvant therapy. Maybe a good way to sort of get into that would be to look at some of the trials that are out there right now, the major phase 3 randomized studies and the questions.
That's a good starting point. And obviously, one that's going full blast, I think is accrual is starting to pick up, is chemo plus or minus bevacizumab in stages 1B through 3A. 1B has to be at least 4 centimeters in diameter or above to be eligible. The other things that are going on, there's a study with erlotinib as adjuvant therapy. You have to have either FISH positivity or even immunohistochemistry is accepted.
I want to pick up on both of those and starting with, again, the patient is a non-smoker or FISH positive or EGFR mutation outside of a protocol setting. How do you approach those patients? Educated patient says to you, how about give me erlotinib after the chemo?
I actually have an Asian patient right now, a woman, never smoker, doesn't have the mutation, but got chemo, and now she's getting erlotinib. And some of those we are doing it, they have the full understanding that it may not be covered, that we don't know that it works, but it's not an unreasonable idea.
In the 1505 study, as you mentioned, the entry criteria in terms of stage, they also restrict the type of chemotherapy that can be received, and it's all cyst-based chemo.
Yes. Yep.
I believe it's cyst docetaxel, cyst gem, and what's the third one?
Vinorelbine.
And cyst vinorelbine.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, how do you approach that decision in a non-protocol setting in terms of selection of chemotherapy off-study?
I'm using cyst, Neil, for all people in adjuvant studies right now, and in fact, we're going to be starting some newer in-house stage 3 studies. Being one of the carbo guys, one of the carbo evangelists, and having been involved in the studies, it's a big change for me. But we all have to keep an open mind. We have to look at the data, and the data are in stage 4, it's cyst is a little better than carbo. Now, they're a little bit better to me isn't worth it in terms of toxicity, so I still use carbo in stage 4. But in stage 3, in an adjuvant where you have a chance to cure some people, I think you better be using cysts because I would, hate to have that be the deal breaker between being cured or not being cured.